even though it didn't happen in this church building, there was a momentous occasion in my youth that is attached to the Kleinwood Church that has had a profound influence on my preaching over the years. It goes all the way back to when W.R. Jones was the local preacher. My friends and I would sit on the front row and we would try as hard as we could to copy down all of his overhead charts that he would place down one after the other. I can still see him putting ones down on heaven and hell and the judgment and the church. And one night, I'm sure Brother Jones thought I was taking very diligent notes, and what in fact I was doing was drawing a picture of him baptizing someone who at the time was very important in my life. It was the Incredible Hulk. And I took Brother Jones the picture after services to show it to him. There wasn't any doubt who it was. He kind of held it out and adjusted his glasses, but he knew who it was. I imagine where most preachers would have told a young boy to go run in the parking lot, he just said, "Well, the gospel is for all." But that's why we're here this week, isn't it? That's why you've come tonight, because of your conviction that the gospel of Jesus Christ is for all. And I appreciate your presence and your interest in God's gospel and your desire to let everyone know it's available to all. I carry with me my pocket New Testament when I preach. If the Bible is the sword, this I call my dagger. It's kind of a handy reference tool that is easy to find New Testament passages. But I would never want anyone to get the impression that since I carry a pocket New Testament, then that must mean that I don't think the Old Testament is important. That since it's a covenant that's been done away, then all of its relevance is no more as well. It's done away. But the New Testament tells us otherwise, doesn't it? It assures us that the Old Testament is the foundation or the tutor that leads us to Jesus Christ. In fact, Paul said in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4 that whatever was written before time was written for our learning. That's present tense. That we, through encouragement and in perseverance of the Scriptures, might have hope. And so I want to encourage you tonight to open in the Old Testament to 2 Samuel chapter 11. And I want to invite you to our next stop on our study of Bible characters and how we can build characters or build our character through these characters whom God has revealed to us, both in Old and New Testaments. Remember, God's desire was to show us these people, that we might cultivate a heart that loves Him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. Thank you for coming tonight. Please begin reading with me at verse 1 of 2 Samuel 11. "And it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, 'Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?' And David sent messengers and took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, 'I am pregnant.' Then David sent to Joab, saying, 'Send me Uriah the Hittite.' So Joab sent Uriah to David. When David came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of the war. And David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. Now when they had told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his house," David said to Uriah, "Why have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel, Judah, staying in temporary shelters. My lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Stay here today also, and tomorrow I will let you go." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. In the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. It came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he had written in the letter saying, "Place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die." So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. And he charged the messenger, saying, "When you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, 'Why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go near the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. And the messenger said to David, "The men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall, so some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead." Then David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, 'Do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him.'" Now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. Major chapters in the life of David are usually divided with the word "and." David and Goliath. David and Jonathan. David and the Psalms. But unfortunately, the life of the man after God's own heart cannot be fully told without a chapter that's called "David and Bathsheba." Three times in the Scriptures, three words are strung together for the sake of emphasis. They're meant to grab our attention. They're meant to put up a red flag. And all too often, these words serve as just the opposite. We overlook them. For instance, we've heard often quoted 1 Corinthians 15 and 33, "Evil companions corrupt good morals." But did you know that's not the whole verse? 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33 starts with three words: "Be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals." That is to say, don't deceive yourself into thinking you can hang around all sorts of bad friends and they're not going to have an influence on you. Don't deceive yourself by saying, well, they're not going to pull me down. I'm going to bring all of them up to the level where I am. The Lord said, don't deceive yourself about that. That's not the way it works. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Don't say to yourself, well, I'm going to go to the party and I won't drink. I'm going to go to the prom and I won't dance. Be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Don't overlook those words. The same applies to Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. Oh, I know that one. That's the one that says, whatever a man sows, this shall he also reap. But the verse begins, be not deceived. Oh, this one little thing won't matter to God. Surely he's not going to care about that. Whatever a man sows, this shall he also reap. Oh, one time won't hurt. Be not deceived. What about 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9? Where the Apostle Paul spoke of the kinds of sins that are going to keep people out of the kingdom of God. Things like fornicators and adulterers and homosexuals. Be not deceived. For those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Is it not so that our society is one that is saturated with sex? I mean, things that ought to cause people to blush in the privacy of their own home are flaunted in God's face. Though our world would convince us otherwise, the sexual relationship between a man and his wife was not created to be something that is dirty, but something that is high and holy. God created an outlet for our attraction to one another and for our sexual desire for our spouse, and that is to be fulfilled in the marriage covenant which He created and sanctified. And when we remove it from its proper context, then we create it to be something God never intended for it to be. It is that third be not deceived passage that I've cited for you that I wish to consider in context of our character for tonight. Be not deceived about sexual sin. And to prove our case, we're going to go to one of the most unlikely characters where you think we would go. The man after God's own heart. Remember, the life of David cannot be told without David and Bathsheba. What is it about this chapter that still causes men and women today to be deceived about the nature of sexual sin? Well, the first thing is, people say this, oh, that'll never happen to me. Now, I know it's happened to others, and there's even been godly people who have given in to temptation and committed sexual sin. But that would never happen to me. I would never do that. Well, just remember who it is we're studying. This was the man who was handpicked by God Himself to be the king of God's people. Now, the first time, Israel got to have their own election. And they got to choose their king. And they chose a man whose their standard was he's head and shoulders above all the other men. God said, well, I'm going to put my standard lower. I'm going to go for the heart. And I'm choosing for myself a man who is after my own heart. I suppose you could look at that in two ways. Number one, David was after God's heart and that he was pursuing the heart of God. He was trying to imitate that heart. But also he was after the heart of God in the same sense as that we would say, this reproduces after its kind and that reproduces after its kind. David was emulating in his life a heart that was like the heart of his father. And God put him on the throne and gave him a throne that would last forever. It was David who defeated Goliath the giant. It was David who twice spared the life of King Saul because he was the Lord's anointed. It was David who became the standard by which all successive kings of Judah would be measured. You read through the lineage of the kings of Judah, and it is, he walked in the ways of his father David. He did not walk in the ways of his father David. And yet 2 Samuel chapter 11 in the New American Standard Bible begins this way with this heading: Bathsheba, David's great sin. You say, I'd never do that. This was the man after God's own heart. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, perhaps another verse that we think we've got memorized, but it's not often quoted correctly. The way we say it is, let him who stands take heed lest he fall. Look at it. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. A few years back, there was a preacher who came through the Pasadena area who was holding a gospel meeting. And he wanted to get several of the young preachers in the area together for lunch and to study. And so several of us went and met him. And he talked about all different kinds of things about local work and things we ought to watch for and things we ought to prepare for and things we ought to preach. And toward the end of our meeting, the discussion turned to moral matters. And he cautioned us about studying with a woman by ourselves or having relationships that would be inappropriate being married men. And one of the young preachers at the table said, well, sir, I love my wife very much and I would never cheat on her. And the older preacher almost put his finger right in his face and said, there's not a man who's ever committed adultery who's not said what you just said. You see, the moment we think that we're immune to the devil's devices, that is the exact moment that he has us in his grasp. Let him who thinks he stands take heed. Just because you've been a Christian a long time, just because you have a good marriage, does not mean you don't need to be watchful about things like this. Don't be like David and think, oh, this would never happen to me. I would never do that. I love my wife too much. I love the Lord too much. Who is it that the wise man describes in Proverbs 7 who makes the way to the harlot's house? Do you remember? He calls him the young and then the naive, or the one lacking sense. He doesn't even realize what he's doing until it's too late. He doesn't even realize where he's going until he can't turn back. One who thought he would never be tempted, Solomon said, just cost him his life. I've seen it happen too many times. Those who thought they could never be tempted this way are making plans when nobody else is home. Those who said this could never happen to me are reserving hotel rooms. Those who thought I would never sin sexually are now carrying out in the body things they first contemplated in the mind. The first thing I want you to see about self-deception in the realm of sexual sin is don't ever say, this could never happen to me. Because that's when we stop putting up barriers. That's when we stop being watchful. That's when we deceive ourselves by the deceitfulness of sin. We learned that from David's sin. But there is a second way we deceive ourselves. And that is to say, number two, well, I can stop this before it goes too far. In other words, I'm strong enough that when I realize that it's getting too close and too hot, well, I can remove myself from the situation and it won't go any further. Did you notice in our reading tonight at the beginning of the chapter how many times David could have turned around and gone back? How many checkpoints along the way where he could have said, well, what am I doing? I have no business doing this. Look at him again. At first it says that it happened in verse 1. At the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants out. So the first thing I want you to realize is David was somewhere that he usually, a place where David usually wasn't there. Is it not so, men, that we need to be very careful about our idle time? Times when we're somewhere we're usually not there. Times when we have discretionary time, leisure time on our hands, and we really don't have anything going, and all of a sudden, our mind takes a turn somewhere else we shouldn't be. And from the roof, verse 2, he saw a woman bathing. I had someone give me some advice once, something that I've passed on to my son, even though he's only 7 years old. And it's a very simple phrase that is called bounce your eyes. If you see something you shouldn't see, bounce your eyes, look away. You're flipping the channel and something comes on there you don't need to be watching, bounce your eyes and turn the channel. Well, David, from the rooftop, from his perspective, was able to look down and he saw a woman bathing. And he could have very easily made the decision, bounce your eyes. Well, I don't need to see that. I better get down from here. But perhaps he thought to himself, well, I could stop this before it goes too far. And then the next verse says, the woman, it's still in verse 2, the woman was very beautiful in appearance. In the Hebrew, that literally reads, she was of good appearance exceedingly. May I ask a question? How did David know that? Because he lingered long on the look. He saw her and he kept looking and saw that she was of good appearance exceedingly, very beautiful. But he didn't stop there. Verse 3, so David sent and inquired about the woman. Back comes the news. Well, she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Never mind the fact that David is married. But now he finds out that this woman is married. And there again was a checkpoint. Well, she's off limits. No need pursuing this any further. She's already taken. And verse 4, David sent messengers and took her. What possible good thing could come from this meeting? What possible good thing could come from David and this woman sitting down and getting to know one another better? But still, he pursued. And one bad decision begat another until finally, verse 4 just says it plainly, he lay with her. All the while, the man after God's own heart was saying, I can stop this, I'm strong, this isn't going to go too far. But all those checkpoints were just plowed right through until he had committed sexual sin against God and against Bathsheba. And against the body that God gave him and the people God gave him to rule. Don't be deceived by saying, I can stop this before it goes too far. Back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the verse right after. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Notice what assurance we're given at verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you may be able to endure it. This verse ought to assure us, first of all, that God is on our side. Have you ever noticed how much blame God gets for the bad things that happen? It's as if God causes this, or God doesn't love us enough. This passage tells us God wants you to succeed. What use would God have for sending His only Son for the sins of the world to redeem us and save us from our sins, only to set up traps that we might fall back into sin? Why would that bring God pleasure? He is faithful. He wants you to succeed. And with the temptation will provide the way of escape also. God knows what you can bear. You know what that says? Whatever you brought with you tonight in this church building, whatever problem you have, whatever difficulty you're going through tonight, God knows you're strong enough to endure. He says He will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able to bear. And though He is not responsible for tempting man, that comes from the tempter, He does provide our way of escape. Did you notice that David didn't take his? All too often, we run past the escape and think, well, I'll take the next exit on down the road. I can stay in this just a little while longer. And if it goes further, if it continues to escalate, then I'll be strong. Solomon asked this question in Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 27. Can a man take fire into his bosom and not get burned? Why is it that we think we ought to be able to get as close as we can to sin and then think we're not going to go over the line? I'll never forget when we were in the church building at Southside, we had some little boys who wanted to see the baptistry. And so I said, well, I'll take you up there to see it. And we had stairs that go up one side and then a little platform where there's a drain in the middle and then the stairs that go down into the water. Well, I was afraid they would fall in. So I said, okay, boys, you can look, but don't go past the drain. I figured that's pretty safe distance. Well, where do you think their feet immediately went to? Right to the edge of the drain. And here I am watching them, and someone from the other side called down to me, so I turned around, and then I turned back, and one of them's leaning over the edge of the water. But that's exactly what we do, isn't it? I want to get my toes right up on the edge. And then I'll move backward. Then I'll retreat. Adultery happens, married people, when we say we're just friends. Now, I know I sent her a text message that I would never say in if we were face to face, but we're just friends. Oh, and I posted a picture on Facebook that I would never put in the church building. But we're just friends. Be not deceived. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? What possible good thing gentlemen, can come from viewing pornography. What good thing will that do for your mind? What good thoughts will that bring you? What good actions will follow? Ladies, what good thing can come from meeting him privately? What good thing? Oh, we're just going to have coffee. What good thing will come from that? And can we not also see Bathsheba's negligence in choosing the place to take a bath? I realize that some ladies may just not know. You might be like the older lady at Southside who I was preaching one time, and her cell phone went off. And it went off and off, and it kept going and kept going. And by the time it finally cycled off, all of us were singing the song of her ringer. And her daughter was mortified. She went up to her afterward and said, "Mom, why didn't you turn your phone off?" And she said, "Well, I was sitting there thinking the whole time, somebody's got the same ringer that I do." And so she never turned it off. That there might be some ladies who just don't know about their dress and how it affects the minds of even the man after God's own heart. That's when we need our fathers and our brothers to help them, so that all of us be not deceived. The best way to stop it is to not even let it get started. Well, there's a third thing that we can deceive ourselves about sexual sin. We can say that this will never happen to me, or I'll stop this before it goes out of control. But the third way we deceive ourselves is when we say, "No one else knows about this. This was a private thing, and so no one else knows what we're doing." As soon as Bathsheba said in verse 5, "I am pregnant," the cover-up began. And David tried several ways to make certain that what had happened between him and Bathsheba remained a secret from the rest of the kingdom. In knowing who her husband was, he had him brought back from the battle, and at first tried to get Uriah to go in and lay with his wife, that people would just assume that the child was Uriah's. But this man had more integrity and character, at least at this chapter, than did David. Because he said, "How can I go into the comfort of my house when the ark of God is in the tabernacle and in the tent at war?" And so David, even after getting Uriah drunk, Uriah refused. And so finally David decided he's just going to have to be killed. And so he had Uriah carry his own death sentence to Joab, which said, "Place Uriah at the heat of battle, withdraw the troops from him so that the enemy would fire upon Uriah." And did you notice what David said when that was exactly what happened and the messenger came back? Did you notice what David's reaction was in verse 25? I can just see him shrugging his shoulders. "Oh, well, sword devours one as well as the other. You win some, you lose some. That's war." But this had not escaped the eyes of heaven. And I want you to notice again what the last verse of this chapter says. The thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. I don't care how private a matter is. I don't care if you've erased your internet history. I don't care if it was in the privacy of your bedroom and no one else outside your house knows about it. It is evil in the sight of the Lord. I don't care if it was a meeting that no one else could trace your tracks and no one else will ever find out. It is evil in the sight of the Lord. Don't deceive yourself into thinking that the eyes of heaven are not attuned. Even when we've been able to cover this up from those whom we love the most, we're still accountable to the Creator. We're going to have to give an account for how we've used our bodies. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 3, Solomon says, "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the good and the evil." When Morgan was first learning to walk and starting to get around the foyer in the church building, she soon discovered the water fountain. And the only problem was she would get more water down the front of her dress than she would swallow. And so Melissa and I would kind of stand back and prevent her from going to the water fountain. Well, one night she realized what I was doing. I was trying to keep her from where she wanted to go. And she finally looked up at me and said, "Daddy, go talk." She knows a preacher, doesn't she? She knew that if I engaged in some conversation, my back was going to be turned and she could go on doing what she wanted to do. There is never a time when the back of our Father in heaven is turned. There is no activity where God shuts His eyes and He's not watching. Now that verse ought to bring us some comfort. God is watching the good. He sees the good we do. We don't have to worry about receiving notoriety or doing it so other people will tell us how good we are. We ought to do it to please God. He's always watching. That ought to be good enough for us. But the same verse ought to at times scare us to death that He sees the evil. You ever been ashamed to sing the phrase in the song, "Light the Fire"? "Lord, you know just where I've been." Sometimes I'm not too proud to admit that. Oh, no one knows. No one will ever find out. We're getting married anyway. Be not deceived. Let marriage, Hebrews 13 and 4, be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Sins carried out in the dark will be brought to light. Every careless word that men shall speak, they shall render account for it on the day of judgment, Jesus said. And I want to remind you tonight, that goes for words that are texted and typed. Be not deceived. No one else knows. God does. And the thing which David had done was evil in His sight. Let us not be deceived by the deceitfulness of sin. Well, thankfully, this is not the final chapter recorded in the life of David. When confronted in chapter 12 by Nathan the prophet, David repented. And with a broken and contrite heart, he accepted the consequences for what he had done. And God forgave him and restored him to the joy of thy salvation. Let us have a character that through honest eyes see sexual sin for what it is. And like the woman who came in contact with Jesus, go our way and sin no more. God's power is able to redeem us from every sin. His mercy and compassion has no boundaries or limits. And when we come before Him with a heart that is broken, He can restore us and make us what we ought to be and give us usefulness in His service, that we may labor for Him all the days of our lives. Zion's call is ringing tonight. Are you ready to respond? It's ringing for those who have wasted opportunities and wasted lives, who want God to resurrect them. Would you come confessing your faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you come repenting of your sins? Then you might be washed clean in the blood of His Son. Would you come back to Him if you've neglected your commitment? If we can help, come right now while He calls, while we stand, while we sing.